The good people at Manscaped have partnered with us here at the Beautifully Designed Game podcast with an exclusive offer just for you as a thank you for tuning in. Visit uk.manscaped.com, enter promo code TFT20 for 20% off your order. Believe me, your balls will thank you.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to the Beautifully Designed Game podcast brought to you alongside These Football Times. On today's episode, I am delighted to be speaking to not only an illustrator, but a filmmaker I have greatly admired. I say from afar, Manchester to Glasgow isn't that far, especially with how we are connected so well in the world these days. And he also happens to follow the slightly wrong variant of red, but still the fact I admire his work evermore says even more for his abilities. It's Jonny Weissberg. Nice to speak to you today, Jonny.
Pleasure to speak to you as well, mate.
Brilliant. Could you, anybody out there who happens to not know the name crazily or your work, could you give people a wee bit of an introduction to you?
Yeah, so obviously you teed it up so beautifully. I don't think I could ever quite aggrandize myself to such a degree as you just did. But I'm an illustrator and a filmmaker. Predominantly, I work in commercials when it comes to filmmaking. And for the best part of the last decade, that's really been my focus. But the past year or two, very much swung as hard as I could into the illustration and artwork side of things. Very much specializing in football and sports stuff, although I do try and dabble in other areas. But it, you know, I think for so many of us in this country, especially, and I guess around the world, football is such a captivating bit of human drama that I find it difficult to ever stop just focusing on drawing footballers that I've idolized.
Okay. And so you spoke then about the last couple of years and your path as an illustrator, that being a focus. So was it always with you before then? It just happened to have been the last couple of years. It's been an area you've put a lot of energy into.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I studied art for a while at college, and then first go round at university was a joint graphic design and film studies degree, but that only lasted a year. And then my focus very much became filmmaking because I saw that was where my career was heading, as opposed to the artwork side of things. I always in the background was doing stuff. So, you know, I'd just be chilling out and not really doing much when I was trying to relax, I guess. I'd be doing digital artwork of films I really enjoyed. So I used to do privately commissioned posters for stuff like the Matrix trilogy. Interstellar was a piece that I did a while ago. So I was always doing that. And then every so often, from about 2013, 14 onwards, that amazing Liverpool season where we had Suarez and Sturridge and we got very close to winning the league under Rodgers, I started creating some artwork that I posted online of the players and the team around then. I was very much kind of contemporaries with people like Carl Thayer and Dave Will, and we all started posting around that time. And obviously those guys continued on from there and became these prolific, really well-known artists, especially in the Liverpool community. But it took a backseat for me because that was just after I finished uni, joined a production company, worked my way up to become a director. And so it would really just be sporadic things. Like I did some digital paintings of some of the 2019 Champions League winning squad when that happened. And it would just be little moments of, exuberant celebration where I felt the need to express something when it came to football, where these bits of artwork would crop up. But then at the start, just before lockdown, I bought myself an iPad Pro and I literally bought it to carry around storyboards on set.
Okay.
It was not bought for any other reason than to stop having to carry around 50 sheets of paper whenever I was filming. And then I just decided to open Procreate one day and start sketching some stuff out, seeing how it felt to kind of put a little bit more energy back into that again. And then that was as we were romping towards winning the league by a million points. And I just felt like that was, to the power of 10, what I'd felt before when it came to needing to just express myself artistically to mark this moment. And then that was kind of my pathway into it. And I've not stopped since.
And can you tell us or give us a wee bit of an insight to the connection with Liverpool Football Club? People might be able to pick up a wee hint with your accent itself, but you work and, well, you're based in Manchester yourself right now. So how does that scenario work out, being such a
obviously it's not the most common thing in the world for somebody to grow up in Manchester but be a massive Liverpool fan, but my granddad and great granddad were both Scousers and both huge Liverpool fans.
Okay,
I remember growing up, one of the most prominent memories I have is there's this framed picture that my granddad had of his dad of a football that was signed by the 78 European Cup winning team.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, the first time I saw that and I asked him about it, and he had all these amazing VHS recordings of teams that, you know, I never got the opportunity to see play live or even see live coverage of. So I grew up really just soaking up my granddad's love for Liverpool and then naturally migrating over to being a Liverpool fan. I guess from my first memories of football, I was already a Liverpool fan. I know that I've got photos of me in like the 93, 94 Adidas, a wet home and away kit, that one that kind of Robbie Fowler made quite iconic, the Adidas equipment one. And I think that
it was a white green,
a white away and
white
green and black away.
Beautiful
kit. I think probably still, not to get too sidetracked, that trio
and I go
kits,
for it.
The red one and then the white green and black and then the yellow third kit, it's probably to me our best set of three kits that we've ever had. All three beautiful shirts.
And I tell you what, the white, that white away one, doing with the eye that I have with looking out for old kits and kind of where to keep an eye out for them, you actually rarely see that anywhere, you know, anywhere that has a very deep collection of old kits. You don't see that one itself often at all. So that must be a rarity when you find it.
Yeah, it is. I think all three of those, again, I think they're pretty high up on collectors' lists. The home kit floats around a little bit more, but you don't often see long sleeve versions of it, which I would absolutely love.
That's true.
But yeah, just, I guess, rewinding a little bit back to my football journey. I think I became a Liverpool fan as soon as I could remember. Again, just like watching those VHSs of the teams that had, like, you know, Rush, Kenny, Barnes in them. Just fell in love with that team immediately. And there was always a part of me that, like, you know, all of my mates were United fans. Quite a bit of my family are United fans. And I just really didn't want to do that.
Okay.
I had no interest in just doing the same thing that everybody else was doing. And none of them spoke with, like, the passion that my granddad and great-granddad had for Liverpool either. So there was almost like a little bit, it felt like a campfire kind of thing, the way that my granddad would talk about those teams and the love that he had for them. So I just naturally connected with that a lot more. And then obviously, you know, when you bond with anything so strongly as a kid, that only grows as you get older.
Yeah, absolutely. And so on my my cousin Paul and my uncle George, they were Liverpool fans when I was growing up. And I actually had the old... I was chatting to Carl Thayer online the other day about this. The old silver candy kit. I remember being given that for Christmas at the time. And when I'm next down south, I think in my mum's place, there'll be some photos of a Christmas with me in that, because I'll find that out as proof, because I think Carl, knowing that I'm that I follow the red side of Manchester, he needs to see proof of me in that. But Liverpool kits from the 90s are, for me, that whole era and me being at school and how such good long summers you always look back on of your time at school. The Liverpool, it was when Reebok were making your kits and there was a cream round neck shirt. Yeah, it always makes me think of Patrick Berger. I think that is one of my most pleasing kits. I don't have it myself, and it's not one of those kits that I ever feel that I would have to have to tick a box, but it's such a nice looking shirt, and even not supporting the team, it can still mean a certain era of time, you know.
Definitely, I think that kit especially is still such a fan favorite. I mean, the Nike kit or the away kit this season is very much like harkening back to that shirt, because it's kind of cream with darker details. I actually recently bought that shirt again, because I had it when I was a kid. Like, you know, I was the kind of kid that went to the shopping center with my mum in a full football kit. I think you don't see that as much nowadays. But that was very much me. You know, socks and all, pulled up to my knees with my trainers. And it's funny, so I bought that shirt off eBay the other day because I saw it for what I felt was a good price, and it had Fowler 9 on the back, and the numbering on that shirt, the black number 9, is kind of it's not velvet, it's like nubuck, like, you know, like you get on some sneakers. So it's got like a tooth to it, which is incredible. But it didn't mention it in the listings. It just came with the socks.
Wow.
So I just randomly now have a pair of those Ecru 96-97 Reebok socks. That's such a beautiful kit. But if I was totally honest about that era of Reebok kits, I think it was mostly pretty bland, other than that specific highlight. Because it was like, there was the round neck 98-99. I suppose
I remember one with the collar.
Well, the 97-98, I want to say, was the one with the... No, actually, I think it was this one. I think it was the home kit to the cream one. Had a collar, because it had the same... So, like, that cream one has the Liver Bird in, like, a satin pattern. So the fabric of the cream is quite... is very matte. It doesn't have much reflection to it, but then it has this kind of satin Liver Bird through it, and the home kit with the collar had the same.
Yeah, okay. It's funny when you look at the fabric of kits from that era, so just in your mind think late 90s to kind of later onwards, and I do wonder whether were sports manufacturers were they discovering new print methods or new print techniques, and they had a brief of, right, let's push this to the maximum. You know, think of the David Seaman toothbrush goalkeeper shirt, and it seemed to be not just what colours could we get, so what pattern could we print on, but when you looked at the fabric up close, there were such different finishes that, you know, you would see brand logos kind of reflected somehow in whatever the print technique was. So really going to town when you look back on them.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I think I feel like I know a bit more about kits now in terms of what goes into them from an R&D process.
Yeah.
But you look back at them in the 90s especially, I feel like they all were very heavy. And I think in part it's because, like you said, they had these new techniques, but they had to be quite thick to maintain them.
Yeah.
But like now, like, you know, the kits are so thin and so lightweight, and it's all about that. Whereas back then,
definitely,
they were almost like jumpers.
Yeah. Really thick material, and the ones that I have from that time, inevitably the sizing was a lot bigger and boxier, so they are heavier as well. And it's such a different if you're wearing it when it rains, just be prepared to feel like you're going home in a thick jumper, you know. Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly.
So Yoni, can you give us a bit of an insight? And I'm talking to you as someone who has an enormous interest in film and animation. And I have spoken to you briefly before that in a slightly alternate world, working as a cinematographer would be a dream. And I learn an enormous amount from the work of cinematographers and the way that shots and sequences are framed. Could you give us an insight as to how do you become a director? How do you do what it is that you do as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's one of those careers, like a lot of creative industries, where there really isn't a specific path. But I would say if there was a time-honored path, especially in commercial work, which I do a lot of, I kind of took that path. So I joined a production company straight out of university. That's not true. So the first job I had out of university, I worked at a corporate production company. So I landed straight on my feet with a job, which, you know, is obviously one of the ultimate goals, get a job in your industry that fits with your degree. But then I was offered work experience by a commercial production company here in Manchester, a production company that I'm still with now called Chief. And I took it. So I left a paid job for unpaid work experience. And then I did 2 weeks work experience there, you know, literally emptying the bins, cleaning the kitchen, making teas and coffees, but made a very good impression. And off the back of that, they offered me a job in the office just as a runner. So continuing that same role, you know, I was first in, last out for a year or two. Again, just trying to make the best impression I could by putting biscuits in front of people. But I think, you know, it's one of those things where you're almost never given a freer hit, because so little is expected of you that if you can do it well, then you do make a good impression. So eventually it kind of came out a little bit that I had a background in graphic design. So I wound up designing posters to go in people's rooms for set design. There was a couple of commercials that we did where something like a faux version of the Racing Times was needed. So I would design that, it would get printed, and then that would be what was on camera. So eventually I got to do more and more of that side of stuff. And then that kind of naturally segued into editing and post-production, doing a little bit of After Effects and that kind of thing for certain jobs. And then eventually I was trusted with some smaller projects where I would get to oversee them and direct them, which just naturally kind of morphed into some bigger commercials and some bigger commercial projects after I was seen to kind of be trusted with those. And I think it's one of those things that is what I dreamed of doing from about the age of 11, was being a filmmaker. I obviously didn't fully comprehend what that could entail, but, you know, so now I'm working on commercial projects. It's funny because as my illustration career has grown, I seem to have done a lot of football work at the same time. Right. So I've had the opportunity to work with footballers like Trent, Harry Maguire, Ox, Raheem Sterling, Phil Foden, done some work with brands like New Balance. And then obviously I've just come off the back of doing the Euros titles for the BBC. And then I've just done the Match of the Day titles for the WSL coverage as well. My career is kind of somewhat homogenized, but it's, you know, it's obviously working very well because the two feed each other. But I think if I was to try and sum it all up in terms of how do you get there, I think it is just putting yourself in the right places. I remember somebody said to me once, I think after they'd just given me my first directing job, they said it was always really easy to give me opportunities because I was always around.
Okay.
You know, just being in front of people that you think can make a difference sometimes can actually make that difference, because the one time or another, after a while, a loose end will come up and you might be the person that can try and grab hold of that or fill that gap. And I think that was somewhat, you know, through perseverance, then having talent and skill to fulfill the role. But it was just being kind of ever present, really.
Okay. And if I can let people know that what I can see as Yoni and I are talking on video right now is that what I would always think of as a director having as their room, so walls full of books and just interesting stuff on shelves. I can tell you, Yoni is sat right in front of a wall just full of what looks like stuff you could open up, and it's full of ideas and ways you can go. So it's nice to know that that kind of dream of what I think is out there actually is out there. So that's super good to know. Could you give us an insight?
A lifelong dream.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, having a wall of books was a lifelong dream as well. So being able to finally do that was great.
Oh, very good. Very good. And there's a couple of Yodas in there as well. So just giving an insight to...
Three baby Yodas.
Oh, three.
Yeah.
So talking of the BBC Euro 2020 at work, could you give us an insight to your role on those and how that came about? And I know Dave Flanagan had some involvement in those, and it'd just be great to hear from someone that was involved in such a visually creative piece of work.
Yeah, so obviously, like you said, Dave Flanagan was involved. It was actually amazing how that came about, which I will get to in a more linear journey of what it was like. So naturally, as it was still called Euro 2020, we actually first were talking to the BBC about it at the end of 2019 or the beginning of 2020. We were, you know, as with any project of that scale and that kind of importance, we were pitching on it. So we pulled together three different ideas to put in front of the BBC. A couple of years before that, me and my producer had done the titles for the international athletics coverage. So, like, you know, whenever there's a Diamond League meet,
yes,
or something like that, we'd done the titles that would go in front of that. So we'd pitched on a few other bits and bobs with them over a couple of years, but had often gotten close, but maybe been pipped by someone else who was also working with them. But we got this opportunity to pitch for the Euro 2020 titles. Me and my producer, Ben, both massive football fans. So, you know, absolutely champing at the bit for that one. Pulled together three very comprehensive ideas, because I often think that it's always good to give somebody something that they can look at and not like, because then as the point of contrast, the other thing is the thing that they might like latch onto. I think from my point of view, with that kind of creative pitch, even if you wholeheartedly believe in one idea, putting one idea in front of somebody, I think it often makes it difficult for them to make up their mind, because they don't have anything to contrast it against. So we gave them these ideas. They came back with a little bit of feedback. So we tweaked it, refined the pitch, and then went back. And, you know, conversations were going really well. And then all of a sudden, March 2020 happened. And I'm sure we're all pretty familiar with what March 2020 entailed. And then everything just kind of went silent, which is fair enough. Obviously, from our point of view, that pitch was our world. But from the people behind the scenes, either at the BBC or UEFA, they had a whole tournament to now figure out when it could be.
Yeah.
So we just didn't hear anything. We knew it had been going well, but we didn't hear anything. And then all of a sudden, 12 months later, almost exactly 12 months later, we got a phone call from the BBC saying, can you pick this up? You know, you were our favourites. We still really like the pitch. Would you be interested in going for it? And I think at that point, we were probably 12 weeks out or something from the tournament, which is not a lot of time to create something like that, because the, you know, our process was, well, now we have to go through all of the teams. We now have to start deciding who are the players, what are we seeing, how does it flow from one scene to the next, who are the team that are going to create it. So, you know, immediately it was just pedal to the floor, let's go, let's figure this out and smash it. And so we had a lot of long days, but, you know, it's such an amazing project that we had no hesitancy in doing that. And funnily enough, I think maybe 2 or 3 days before we got that phone call, I'd listened to your podcast with Dave. You said to him, what's your dream project? And he said to do titles for the BBC, to work on titles for the BBC for a major tournament. And Dave is an artist that I've followed forever. Like, I think I bought a print off him the best part of 10 years ago. He did these very expressive kind of sketched illustrations of, I know Zidane was one of them because that's the print I bought. And I think it was on a blue background, and it was very rough, and it had a lot of feel to it. And I've been a big fan of his since then. And we knew that we needed to have a lot of control over the illustration team. We needed it to both feel diverse, but at the same time, have a lot of connective tissue. And Dave's a master of many styles. So I immediately said to my producer, I was like, what if instead of getting six artists, we got one artist that can give us six options?
Yeah.
So we got on the phone with Dave pretty shortly after that. And he came on board, which was really exciting because it meant to me that I now had absolute confidence that we could more than meet the deadlines that we needed to. And so from there, my role on it was I kind of oversaw the whole thing. So, you know, my role on it within the production company and with our team was I was the director, but you could almost probably have referred to me more as the art director.
Okay.
In a more traditional sense. So I designed all of the frames. And then along with my producer, we came up with what all of the elements were for each of the teams or each of the scenes. And then I'd put them together along with Dave's illustration as almost like one big piece of artwork and then handed it off to the animators with notes as to how I saw the animations come into life.
Yeah.
And it was an ever evolving process. So, you know, there was a few things that were not great news, like Zlatan pulled out, Van Dijk was obviously injured and missed the tournament. So there was some last minute artwork changes. And I know that Dave is particularly proud of the Zlatan and Sergio Ramos that he did. And he's posted them on social media since. So I'll definitely have a look at those. But we had to obviously take a couple of players out and constantly adding things and tweaking things.
That's interesting for people to hear that the last minute production considerations and how and how, you know, either selection or injuries to players affected what you guys were working on.
Yeah, that was a constant thing because we were always worried that we might pick players that just weren't that prominent. So, for instance, we made a decision pretty early on that our three most featured players for England were going to be Rashford, Harry Kane as captain, and Raheem Sterling. But in the last few weeks of the season leading up to the Euros, Sterling wasn't getting picked that much for City. And so all of a sudden, we were a little concerned that maybe he's not going to play that prominent a role at the Euros. But then obviously he did, and he was probably England's player of the tournament. So that was kind of fantastic. But, you know, there were still a few little tweaks that we made during the tournament. And that was, I think, one of the things that BBC really liked about our approach was that we said we'd always be ready to tweak things. So one of those was, obviously, there was the tragic incident with Christian Eriksen. Yes. So after that, we put a heart with the number 10 on Kasper Schmeichel's jersey within the scene.
Yes.
Just as like, you know, as a little nod to what the players had done, the heroics there. And obviously just our way of bringing a little bit of that well-wishing spirit that everybody had around that moment. And also the other thing was we constantly refined the end frame. So the original end frame was all of the teams. Each team had one player. They were arranged within their groups. But then as the tournament progressed, we'd strip players out. So it went from 32 to 16 to 8 to 4 to eventually for the final. It was just Marcus Rashford across from, I want to say Insigne, but I could be wrong.
Okay. And in terms of the production process from you starting, so you pitched three different routes, and from you having the approval on the chosen route and you starting to really map out the storyboard on those, and then the final edit being approved, how long roughly was that timeline?
Probably somewhere around 6 weeks.
Okay, right.
So I think about the halfway point, we had a very rough blocked out animatic. So I think some of Dave's illustrations will have been in there, some just reference imagery, but we'd started to get the flow of the animation transitions in there. So you could see them. So you could see the shape it was taking. I think that was probably about the point at which the quote unquote edit was approved. And then from there, it was just constantly refining the animation, constantly doing what we could to make it better, you know, never shirking a decision that would make more work if it was going to make the thing better.
Okay. Okay. And you have such a portfolio from animation to film. As a director, do you have a preference as to which you most enjoy working with, or is it really about whatever's correct for the brief or whatever's correct for the narrative? It's simply the chosen medium.
I think I have a very different love for both. So like, okay. They almost don't occupy the same part of my brain. So I think a lot like right. you. So at university, studying film production, I was a cinematographer.
Right, okay.
So I shot all of my classmates' films. And that was what I felt my focus was going to be for the first couple of years of uni. So I have an adoration for lighting and production value and being yeah. on set and seeing something come to life once it's seen through the camera. So I don't think anything detracts from that or anything beats that. But at the same time, I'm such a nerd that I love just being behind my computer for 12 hours a day. So okay, I also really... Right. I really enjoy the minutiae and the fiddliness and the, you know, the technicalities of animation and doing everything you can to get that right.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And then if we take a sidestep to your illustrative work, can you tell us, having such a love you have of Liverpool Football Club, how does that then, like, is it a very natural connection to create visual content based on the club that you love? Like, is it a very natural process for you want to visually show how much you love the football club?
I couldn't say anything other than yes, because perhaps the piece that at least loved among the Liverpool community that I'm known best for is a piece celebrating the squad that won the title. And I'll be totally honest, my thought process at the time, and this still continues basically to this day with every piece that I create, is if it wasn't so narcissistic to do so, I'm basically just creating stuff I would want on my wall.
Right, yeah, okay.
So, you know, I could see in my head the poster that I wanted on my wall to celebrate us finally winning the league after such a long time. So I made it, and it wasn't really for anybody else other than me, but then like the response was so positive that it became for a lot of other people as well. But it definitely is incredibly easy to create stuff around Liverpool. I sometimes have to be disciplined, and to the point now where I'm kind of always doing one-off. So I'll do a Liverpool piece and then I'll do something non-LFC based. Okay, and then I'll go yeah. backwards and forwards, because I know that, you know, as somebody who I want to have some longevity doing this, I know that I can't pigeonhole myself too much in that sense. And I've been lucky enough now to have the opportunity to do a number of pieces that both are and aren't Liverpool based. But I think I was talking to a friend of mine at the weekend, actually. So I was catching up with some uni friends, and we were talking about, obviously, the football story that everybody's been talking about, which is Ronaldo back to United.
Yeah.
I was saying that the Liverpool fan in me hopes it's a catastrophic failure, because obviously that's kind of what I yeah. yearn for every time United step onto the pitch, is a demoralizing loss.
Yeah.
But there's the other part of me, which is like the romantic, where one of the things that I love about football so much, which is why I think it's so easy to create art around football, is the narrative, the storytelling of football. I
yeah.
think you know, most great sports have it, but football probably more so, because it's so global, because there's so many big figures, because the clubs themselves are so gargantuan. There's part of me that thinks, like, in 30 years, it'd be amazing to be talking about how Ronaldo went back to United and did something amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that part of me as well that makes it just easy to create artwork and content around football in general. I think the other benefit that I have is being in Manchester, being a filmmaker. I've done a lot of projects for clubs that aren't Liverpool. I've actually still not had the opportunity to make any to direct anything for the club myself, but I've made films for United, I've made films for City, I've made a film for Everton.
Okay, yeah.
So I think I already had that somewhat professional cap on. And I was like, yeah, I don't mind drawing Sergio Aguero. I don't mind doing like the Champions League artwork I did for Gazprom, where it was Chelsea and City players. Like, you know, work is work and football's football. I'm fine doing this. Whereas I know a lot of other people probably would have come out in hives.
Yeah. Well, there's a real basketball and feel to a lot of not only the trainer based illustrations that I've seen on your portfolio, but I've seen you make reference to your interest in basketball, and I say that as you're wearing, I can tell people, an Air Jordan t-shirt as we speak.
That is true.
So you have a there's a connection to basketball for you as well.
Yeah, massively. So my dad, when I was much younger, 7 or 8, we went to see kind of that peak era Bulls team in Chicago.
So, wow. You know,
Pippen, Jordan, Rodman. So I got to see that team play and had a huge love for basketball ever since. Not many people will probably remember them, but the Manchester Giants had somewhat of a positive era in the late 90s and early 2000s, and we had season tickets to go and see them. So basketball was something that I always adored as well. Still do, still have a big affinity for basketball. I would say I probably have more pairs of basketball kicks than I do football shirts at this point. It's close,
oh, really?
But probably more sneakers. So yeah, basketball is probably, when it comes to sport, my second love.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I didn't watch it too much, probably 1998 to 2004. I didn't watch it as much, but I think that's, if anything, more just to do with the fact that it wasn't as easily accessible on TV. It wasn't on Sky as much.
Yeah, okay. And when it comes to your trainer collection, do you have is there a certain look of trainer you like? Is there a certain era, or are you pretty open when it comes to your trainer collection?
I think I have more of a connection to the stuff that is very much streetwear and function. So obviously there was a big, I think there probably still is a bit with Adidas in the like mid 2010s, when they had all of the Ultra Boost stuff, was really prominent. And I think it was just as Under Armour were becoming very popular, they had a real tech focus. So it was almost like you could see the R&D on display. So, you know, you could see like almost a lot of the skeletal work that made the sneakers so good. And then Adidas did some similar stuff with like their LeBrons, where they started to almost look like a sneaker that RoboCop would have worn.
Yeah,
and that stuff doesn't really do it for me. I like, you know, I grew up being in love with Air Max 95s, Jordan 4s, that kind of vibe. So stuff that has a streetwear focus is almost always the thing that I gravitate to more. I do really like a lot of Nike's VaporKnit stuff, and the Flyknit stuff is really beautiful. And I think they've managed to, with that kind of technological advancement, they've managed to kind of bring that back, where it is obviously a very technologically advanced sneaker, but still looks really cool because it's still fabric. It doesn't have a lot of hard pieces to it, which I think is something that I didn't really like about that kind of 2012 to 2016 period, I think I would say. So yeah, it's probably that. It's just streetwear stuff is more my jam, but I like it when it's been connected to something really successful. So, you know, if there's a little bit of an aura around Pete Jordan sneakers because he wore them when he was dominating the NBA, probably similar to that period of LeBron's where he was by far the best player on the planet. So they feel as though they have a little bit of magic about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yoni, can you let people know where they can find your work online? Because there are two different URLs. Is that correct? Both of them connected, but somewhere where people can see you as a filmmaker and your illustrative work as well. Can you let people know where they can find you online?
Yeah, of course. I would say probably the best place is my Twitter. I'm most prolific on Twitter. So that's at Yoni Weisberg on there. I also have that tag on Instagram, but that's more of my film account. And then Art by Yoni W on Instagram is where I post all of my artwork stuff. And then from there, I've got my links to my various websites. So yoniweisberg.com and artbyyoni.com are both of kind of my different portfolios for different things.
Okay. And you you did mention it earlier. I did ask the very same question to Dave Flanagan. But so if I was going to ask it to yourself, what would be your... it'd be interesting to hear your kind of dream brief and whether that could be film-based or illustrative-based, or maybe you get a chance to combine the two. I don't know, and to art direct and to direct yourself.
I think, I feel like I've got loads.
Brilliant.
I'm trying to narrow it down to one because I've got at least three that sprang to mind immediately. I think something that I feel like you could combine both into, and I feel like they have in the last number of years, is I feel like it would definitely be that Nike commercial that sits alongside a major tournament. You know, whether it's the Euros or the World Cup, I wouldn't really mind. But I think those campaigns are always iconic. And to be able to work in creating something like that, I think would definitely be incredible.
Okay. And we, you spoke about narratives previously, and it's a big love of mine and sport, and turning on and I'll tell you what, I really enjoy listening to football matches and radio commentary these days, because I think they do such a good job of describing the game, but then that also gives you that wee bit of license in your own mind to make up what's happening in your head as well. I'm just going to go off on one a wee bit here, because I'm very conscious I'm talking to a filmmaker who I admire, and I'm going to get a chance to give you an insight to how my mind gets distracted with narratives. You know, even when I'm playing as a goalkeeper, as we did last night, and if it's seven aside, so obviously there's more of a chance for the action to be away from you than five aside when you're always on it. But I like thinking, so the different groups of guys I play with each week for the different fives and sevens games, they're all different groups of people. And two of the groups, I don't see any of those people outside of that football at all in the week. I don't even really know what most of them do. It's just first name basis. But when I've got some distracted time as a goalkeeper, my head starts thinking about what these people could have been doing during the week, and the fact that there's this one football match that everybody comes to create our own narrative within the game. And, you know, everybody brings their own stories behind their week and what their life has been. And it's all coming together for this one game now. And you can pick up narratives in any possible way when it comes to people coming together to compete in that way, you know. And I absolutely let my mind just drift off when I'm playing as a keeper, you know. And it was interesting you said earlier very specifically about narratives in football, you know.
Yeah, I think it's such a powerful thing. I totally agree with you about the radio, by the way. I think they do. Yeah. I mean, obviously they kind of have to, but they do such a better job of painting a picture of the game. Whereas, and this sounds ridiculous, but I feel like even the best commentators on TV now, because I feel like we're not in the greatest era of TV commentators. They're just saying what they see. Like they're not bringing it to life in a way that does anything other than is basically audio description.
Yeah, I got you. So would there be what for you, is there a specific golden or better period of, or were there particular commentators who were maybe not around now who you think, you know what, we're missing their voices?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that 90s era as the Premier League was evolving, as football became more exciting. You know, I think there was an era of Martin Tyler where he was very good. I do think Peter Drury is an excellent commentator now. He, you know, he waxes lyrical at no end about not just what's happening in front of him, but the wider implications, the elements that could feed into it. And I think that's what we used to get a lot of from football commentators. I think, you know, peak John Motson was obviously an iconic voice to apply to football. But I think it was because we were experiencing their excitement for the evolution of football.
Okay.
There was some, right, I think there was maybe something about that. And I suppose the other side of it is it's wall-to-wall coverage now, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
It used to be that maybe Match of the Day was the only way you were going to see that coverage, or if, you know, you weren't at the match and this was your one opportunity, whereas now you go on Twitter, the highlights are there. You might watch Match of the Day. Sky Sports have all their highlights on YouTube. BT Sport have already retweeted the video about it. So maybe it's just a little bit of desensitization.
Yeah. Okay. Hearing your view as someone who works with both visuals and audio when it comes to combining the two, I feel like I'm getting a little bit of a different voice there, which is grand to hear as well. And let's talk about sports documentaries, as we are blessed in so many ways this world. And I was down visiting my mum last week, and I watched Three Kings again recently. These Shankly, Busby and Steen, Jock Steen documentary that I can only recommend to people to watch it. Are there any that you have recently watched, Yoni, that you would like to wax lyrical about, or any particular recent sports documentaries that you've seen that have really caught your interest?
I'm trying to think of as to what I've watched. Recently, one of the biggest problems with being addicted to watching anything and everything is that I often have to refer back to my Letterboxd account to actually see what I've watched. I think, like, you know, you can't talk about sports documentaries without bringing up the work of Asif Kapadia. I think he is somewhat peerless. Like, you know, Senna's amazing, Maradona's amazing. He's an incredible filmmaker. I think when Senna came out, it revolutionized the approach to archival documentary filmmaking. I'm actually really pleased because he liked a tweet of mine many moons ago, quite randomly. And so I DM'd him, sent him a link to my short film, and also said, like, I know you're a Liverpool fan, would love to send you a print to have up in your office. So he's got a print of mine up in the office where...
Oh, fantastic.
..where he works away being an incredible filmmaker. So I think those are brilliant pieces of work, no doubt. I actually, you know what, for the first time recently, I watched One Night in Turin, which I'd never seen before.
Oh, really? You are actually reminding me. I have always had that on my list for a long time, but have not watched it.
Have you not? It's fantastic. It's so singular as a film. Because I was kind of just expecting a somewhat BBC Channel 4 vibe talking heads documentary, but it's got some really incredible bits of creativity in there. It doesn't just rely on broadcast coverage footage. They actually recreate a lot of pivotal moments from that tournament and England's journey through Italia 90 by shooting these close-up, like, dramatized moments. Like, if a goal's scored, you'll see a close-up of a boot and then a close-up of the ball rippling the net, almost in this kind of dark void with this really magnetic sound design. So it's a really interesting film to watch. I was somewhat surprised by how creative it was, because I think there's a template of that kind of film that a lot of us have in our minds, and it is not that at all. I also, probably 6 months ago, watched the Arsenal 89 documentary, which really, really good film. And is obviously, I was expecting to just be miserable watching 90 minutes about that harrowing moment at Anfield, But it's actually a really interesting portrait of that era of Arsenal and seeing some of the most prominent figures talking about what George Graham brought to the club, how different it was moving into a much more demanding and regimented era. So I think that's a really good piece of filmmaking as well.
Fantastic. Brilliant. And I'm going to shuffle up my running order, as this is a question I meant to ask you far earlier today. A specific piece of work, your front cover, your Inter Milan front cover for these Football Times. Could you talk us through the composition itself specifically, the circular kind of base to the layout and the composition, and essentially where the front cover concept came from?
Yeah, of course. I mean, conceptually, it was quite a short journey. Like, so Omar got in touch with me initially, saying like, we're doing this inter issue of our magazine. I think your Liverpool piece could be a really great reference for the cover. And so that piece has the Premier League trophy at the heart of it. And the title that, if it was in a gallery, that it would have underneath it was the team that tore up the history book. So that's why it's all these ripped pieces. Even the trophy is made up of several layers almost. And so he said that to me, and immediately I thought, well, the Inter badge is debatably the greatest, the older crest, not the new one, is debatably the greatest crest in football, maybe the most iconic in terms of its shape and its own composition. So I went back to him a few days later with a really rough sketch of what I thought it could be. And I was like, I know you referenced my Liverpool piece, but I thought, you know, it's the history of an iconic club. We'd already discussed getting multiple players on there. I think the original number we discussed was somewhere like 15 or 16. But I went back and said, instead of my Liverpool piece, what if we took the logo as the center point? And then since we're looking at the history of the club, we expand that circle outwards continually, like ripples through history. We'll have 19 layers within the design because of the 19 Scudetto that Inter have won, the most recent being just last season. And then over time, we upped the number of players from like 15, 16 to 19 in the end, just to make the composition feel right. And the way that I laid it out was essentially almost like a spiral. So I think it's Giuseppe Meazza who's at the who's like the first figure that you see just above the logo.
Yes.
And then round from there, you get more and more contemporary. So it's like the oldest players at the center, the more recent ones on the outer edge. And that was it. It was literally the first idea that popped into my head. Obviously, whenever that happens, I then spent 2 days interrogating myself as to whether or not that was lazy. Was there a better idea? Should I just go with my gut? And in the end, we did. And I think it worked really well and feels so much more connected to the visual identity of the club as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's such a terrifically striking cover. It absolutely is. And it was the because I have a real fondness for into the club and essentially how and why the club was established, and especially that crest. And the first time I saw the cover, my eyes were just drawn straight into this is leaning from the crest. So that pulled me in ever more. And it's such a lovely colour palette of a club identity to work with as well. And it was a lush cover, absolutely. And actually, I've meant to ask you, the first time I've asked a Liverpool fan this week, what do you think of this season's third shirt, which is the yellow and with the red trim this year?
I'm into it. So
yeah, me as well, yeah.
So obviously, I mean, if I can be totally honest, the online Liverpool community is not in the best place. It's a bit fractured at the moment.
Is there a particular reason for that, or is it just how it is at the moment?
No, there is a particular reason. It's because we didn't buy loads of players in the transfer
window.
I'm sure there will have been seasons where you can somewhat relate to this as a United fan, probably not this summer, but City and Chelsea, especially City, have set this kind of false bar where fans now just seem to think you can go out and buy whoever you want, whenever you want.
Yeah.
So we did not do that. So Liverpool fans are very angry. So a lot of fans now, no matter what the club do, react very angrily. That's not to say that there aren't a lot of very level-headed Liverpool fans who really dislike it. There's memes going around about how it looks like a McDonald's, something or other, although I've not said this to anyone, but as a person who has for my entire life paid a lot of attention to visual identity, other than the fact it's red and yellow, in no way does it reflect anything McDonald's have ever had. I can't for the life of me, yeah, other than maybe the floor of their restaurants in the 90s, think of where they've had checkerboards.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
That's but no, point, but yeah. My opinion on third shirts is like, is swing for the fences, like go yes, as wild as possible. Like, you know, the Barcelona one that dropped yesterday, I think that's brilliant. Yeah. So distinct. Yeah, I think there's this, and this is purely speculation on my part, I feel as though there is very much a movement amongst the big sporting manufacturers at the moment to make instant cult kits or future cult kits.
Yes.
So the designs are crazy. They're as wild as they were peak 90s. And I think this is one of those ones that we'll look back on in 10 years, if we have a good season, probably, and go, man, you know what? It's really funky and I kind of love it because it's so out there. So yeah, I'm super into it. And the weirder, the better for away and third kits. Push the boat out, get some proper patterns in there. I'm all for it.
Yeah. And what do you, do you have a similar appreciation with the bold with Juventus's third? It is their third kit, the blue and yellow.
Yes,
it's not the away kit, is it? It's the third kit.
It is the third kit.
Okay.
No, I do not.
Okay. Do you know what I am? Sorry to jump in. Do you know what I find enormously distracting about the Juventus third kit? It's not actually anything to do with the third kit in itself. It is the fact that, like, G, I think, is a lovely type-based sponsor to have.
But not with the extra bit that they've added.
Yes. The 4XE, I think it says. Yeah. But in it has a kind of washed gradient that means it looks like something's being ironed on. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just in my eyes. I can't see past that this season.
It looks to me, it looks like the gradient that you used to find on some word art presets.
Ah, right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is. Yeah. It's like it almost looks like it's supposed to be metallic.
Yes.
Because you're absolutely right. Like, because Inter's third kit last season, I think it was their third, might have been fourth even, was not that dissimilar in terms of it was a jumble of shapes and colors. In fact, the color palette was really similar. But yeah, I think because I actually don't like any of Juventus's kits this season. And I think it is entirely because that 4XE, like, I just don't know how you make a color palette that's going to feel cohesive unless all of a sudden you just decide to use their branding colors.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it was, there's only two that spring to mind. And actually, they are two kits that I have a real likeness for. But they also happen to be the only two kits that the Chevrolet logo on the United shirt, because of that gold metallic finish. I'm wholly accepting of sponsors. I absolutely am. I think sometimes kits can look lacking without them, you know. But When it's a gunmetal gold metallic finish, nothing is ever going to do anything other than butt up against it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
there was two kits that was a less of a distraction, so that the beautiful work of the kit designer themselves has a full platform and it isn't, you know, washed down by something that's distracting your eyes, you know.
So yeah, so two, I want to just come back at you with two things now.
Sure.
So one, totally agree with you. I think you said it on a podcast a few moons ago. You were talking to somebody about your favorite kits. You mentioned that New Balance Celtic one, which I know you you often like to bring up as one of your personal favorite kits of all time.
Yeah.
But I agree that I think a sponsor now, because they're so familiar, And it depends on the club. Like, I can see a Roma shirt without a sponsor and a Barca shirt without a sponsor, and it look fine.
Yeah.
But they feel like a necessary part of the architecture now. Some of them definitely look nude without them. And then secondly, so what do you think of the TeamViewer branding then as a sponsor?
All of a sudden, I feel as if we are in a world where, and if I may also bring up at the same time, Leicester City's sponsor.
Oh, awful.
Now, TeamViewer, there is nothing there that is the least inoffensive sponsorship. If you are going to find something to complain about with that in life, you are going to find a lot of things to complain about. I am naively optimistic when it comes to all aspects of life. TeamViewer, it's actually quite a nice thing to read on a team shirt. aspect, you know. It's a single colour. It's not being created with the same typeface that Avatar uses for its logo. But also, I'm conscious that and the Leicester sponsor logo. It also feels to me as if we're in a world where all of a sudden there's something very different. That might seem as if it's just been typed out and placed on there. But no, I am. It's nice to not have a betting company, an oil company, an airline from a place that you wouldn't particularly ever choose to go to yourself, and an alcohol brand. It's nice to not, like, I really liked it when Chelsea had Yokohama Tires as a sponsor. Because a tire company, and it actually is a nice typeface, you know.
Yeah.
So if that's a long-winded answer to your question, I can't find anything to be offended by TeamViewer. What about you?
No, it was. I think much like the Leicester City one, which is a great reference, and you sometimes see it with titles in movies. So a reference that almost nobody will be able to picture when I say it is. If you watch the fourth Mission Impossible movie, Ghost Protocol,
right?
So that's a $200 million movie, and it brings up their location titles. So like they go to Dubai, so it says Dubai, and it's in Ariel, and
right.
Who's working on a $200 million movie and doesn't go, do you want to change the font? Like how does that happen? How do you just use the default typeface that's in like Final Cut Pro or Premiere? I don't get it. And it's the same thing with. Is it FPS, the Leicester one, or FPS,
yes,
or something like that? It's just a very standard typeface. So is TeamViewer, which I find interesting. My biggest thing, though, is because there's been a lot of Photoshops done on Twitter and Instagram over the past couple of months where it'll show like United's kit this season, which is a very clean kit, Liverpool's away kit, which is a beautiful kit. And it'll show it with Sharp on it for United or Carlsberg for Liverpool. And I think Sharp especially, I can't help somewhat yearn for the world, not necessarily like in a retro, oh, I think the logo looks great, but a world where a provincial electronics company could sponsor the biggest club in world football. Like that just seems like such a bygone era. Like, I was at the Classic Football Shirts exhibition at the weekend.
Yeah.
West Ham shirt with Dr. Martens on it. I'm just like, that's not happening now.
Can I just press pause on you there 1 second and give me 2 seconds as where I am talking to you right now, if I can just pull up
amazing.
On camera.
Exactly.
So just so people can know, on Wednesday's five-a-side football, which was actually a six-a-side game in the end, which was fun on a five-a-side pitch, I wore a West Ham feeler, the away shirt that had Dr. Martens as a sponsor. So there you go. Good reference there.
Yeah, that worked out really well. But you can't imagine a world where Dr. Martens are sponsoring a Premier League football club now, can you? And it seems strange that we ever lived in that world.
Yeah, but then at the same time, I think with all of a sudden, I mean, TeamViewer, I'm self-employed. I work from home, so TeamViewer might be something that people who don't have that set up are far more aware of. I'd never heard of them before, and I've never heard of Leicester's new sponsor. So the point you're bringing up, I agree with, but and at the same time, the fact that we have two sponsors I've never heard of quite high profile Premier League club. Oh, it's quite nice. This it's not everyone is sponsored by Emirates or the same four or five companies, you know. But no, I absolutely get where you're coming from. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. Though I'd never heard of TeamViewer when I first saw it announced. I texted my nephew, who's a United fan, and said it sounds like something that I would have got on a free CD-ROM on the front of a PC magazine in the 90s.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
I don't know what this is, mate.
Yeah. And I do remember those CD-ROM magazines that you speak of as well. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's the world was a purer place when you got free software on a CD-ROM and you used to buy PlayStation magazine to play the demos.
That's very true, yes. And actually, you're making me think of the Amiga, well, the very same magazines I would buy, but for Amiga discs, for the Amiga 500. That's
a friend of mine who was a couple of years older had an Amiga. And we used to play, I want to say it was like Road Rash or Road Rage, which was a motorcycle game where you used to club people with crowbars and steal their motorbikes.
Yeah, and there was like a chain, like a short strip of metal chain that you would use in that same manner. I think you're right with Road Rage. I think you're right on that. Yeah.
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 Great game. Absolutely. Like a precursor to Grand Theft Auto in some ways.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. Well, you're making me, you're pining for the fact that I haven't set up the PlayStation here at my new place, which needs to be done for this weekend. Absolutely. So talking of this weekend, and this will give people a good time reference for when we're talking today. Who have Liverpool got this weekend and how do you feel about this weekend?
We've got Leeds away.
Oh, what a fixture.
I know, yeah.
Fans there as well.
Yeah, I feel as though, like, I looked at United's game against Leeds at the start of the season, and I don't understand why we don't do what you guys do to them, where they should just be like the perfect team for us to play. They're so open. You know, they have no pretenses of trying to stop you playing. So I feel as though we should be able to just batter them, but we beat them 4-3 at the start of last season and then we drew 1-1 with them later on in the season. They're a really tough team to play against because I think, I wouldn't even say it was a debate that they are the fittest team in the league. They could run for days. You know, they really, really get after you. I think the trick against them, which United have done a couple of times in a row, is if you score early, then they go for it to an even greater extent. And they're so exposed. I feel pretty confident. You know, I think we've got a really good team this year. We've got all of our players back from injury. Van Dijk looks like he's not missed a beat. And I think, you know, Jurgen Klopp is one of the most charismatic men to ever exist in football. But I can imagine no better manager for the year after a pandemic where, you know, he's basically just telling everybody that, you've basically got a second go at what we didn't manage to do last year, which is, you know, trying to get the Premier League title back, doing it in front of fans. And I personally think we should have a good season. I think this weekend we should get a result against Leeds. I think we're one of those teams where we love playing in an atmosphere. It can be hostile, it can be friendly, but we have players that just absolutely get up for it when there's energy within the stadium. So fingers crossed I don't look back at this podcast in months like a fool because we didn't get a good result. But no, I feel good about it. I think obviously there's a lot going on this weekend. I don't know. My nephew, as I said, is a United fan. He was trying to get tickets for the Newcastle game at Old Trafford, presuming that Ronaldo would make his debut. I don't know if that's happening. There seems to have been talk that it might be the game after.
I can tell you I've been pretty attentive this morning in doing everything I can to confirm that I haven't heard he's not, so I'm going to take that as all guns blazing for a second debut. Poor Steve Bruce.
Have any fitness issues.
Poor Steve Bruce. When you face challenges as a Newcastle manager.
Yeah, you do. And he's. Am I right in thinking Steve Bruce has still never beaten United as a manager?
No, you are right. And I'm pretty sure, and I might need correcting on this, I think he's actually might have lost every game.
I think so. I was going to say that.
Yeah. So, an ever more better weekend for Steve Bruce.
Yeah, God, Newcastle. There is not a team I feel sorrier for, at least in the Premier League, but maybe in world football as Newcastle. I was watching Premier League years 2008-2009 just randomly over breakfast with some friends the other week. I don't know why I was doing it to myself because it was really brilliant. And then we got up to Kiko Makeda's goal against Aston Villa, which essentially ended our title challenge. And I was just depressed for the rest of the weekend. But, so in 2008-2009, Newcastle fans were protesting for Mike Ashley to leave.
Yeah.
And you know, that's 13 years ago.
Yeah. And I mean it, I sincerely do not hope that I sound patronising in any possible way at all. But Newcastle, if any club is just there to exist for nothing but positivity, and if any club is absolutely ripe to be ready to at least be as straightforward to exist and to have all of the support in your local area behind you, it's Newcastle. And for that to be the club that is just that, it's just got a big shiny Sports Direct sale tape around it, you know, and I'd imagine that's ever more frustrating, you know, to have everything there right in front of you, but it's all just got a cheap sticker over it for no fault of their own as well, you know. Yeah.
I think especially for those of us that grew up with, you know, with our love for football being cemented in the 90s, I'll always have so much affection for Newcastle.
Yeah.
Because they were such an entertaining team in that mid-90s period. And yeah, you feel as though under a different circumstance, they're a huge club just waiting to knock around, aren't they? Like, you know, like you said, they've got everything there. They've got a massive stadium, huge fan base, they're suffering for such a long time. I do really feel for them
because it was actually there's the Bobby Robson era as well, which was their actual European Cup beating Barcelona, you know, and so it was actually got better than Kevin Keegan, you know, in terms of level of there, you know what. Well, and I tell you what, if ever you want a sincerely rewarding football manager game and you're not having a game with your own club, Newcastle is such a good club to play on Football Manager and grow to a European giant because it has everything there ready and waiting.
That's interesting. You know, I don't think I've played Football Manager properly, like seriously, since Championship Manager 4.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it got too detailed for me.
Yeah, I get.
I basically want the FIFA Manager career mode.
Yeah.
Football Manager.
But yeah, I like playing the Football Manager 16-17 because I like to then find out players that are around now that were a good age to pick up when they were a young teenager back then. And also because it's a few seasons older, you can see how a whole different universe has slightly developed. So at the moment I've changed European football with Aberdeen. That's the universe in that world, you know, and I've got Phil Foden playing for Aberdeen, you know, so there's players around now that whose careers you can see going down slightly different variants. But see, I get your point, but for me and the way I play it and that period of Football Manager, I don't think it goes down that overly. Like I don't feel like I'm having to analyze so much data with every single player, you know.
Yeah. Did you play 16-17 in 16-17, or have you recently picked that up?
I think I probably had it when I first got it. It was probably a year old at the time, I think that was actually after a wee break from playing it. That was me getting back into it. But it's such an ideal version of the game for me. You know, I'm sure at one point I'll graduate to 17, 18, but I like being able to kind of go back in history and start from then, you know?
So you're kind of Back to the Future sports almanacking it, aren't you?
Yes.
You've signed Phil Foden because I presume in 16, 17, he was still listed with massive potential.
Yeah. Well, because the thing is, in that universe, I play it through Steam, they are clearly able to update the database in a way which is grand. But because you get players in that database who maybe weren't scouted back then and weren't necessarily as good as they are in real life, and you get kind of vice versa as well, you know, you get players that are smashing it in that world that, you know, in reality, their career was spent, you know, in the lower reaches. And so it's just good to see how the different narratives can work out in different ways, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is interesting.
So what's happening for you the rest of this Friday, Yoni? Have you got, do you work on Fridays? Do you schedule it in any particular way? Is it dependent on what briefs you've got happening?
Yeah, I suppose my schedule for my life kind of just depends on what's going on. I work all the time. Because both filmmaking and illustration are my favorite hobbies as well as what I do for work. They're what I do to relax. So, you know, other than watching films and watching TV, if I just want to go and chill out, I'll just go and sit in front of my iPad and start drawing something, or I'll start doing some research to try and get some writing done. So I feel genuinely I do kind of work all the time, but in part of that, it's because as with yourself, I'm self-employed. So some days I like to get up at 6, smash out 4 hours of work, then take a few hours off and get back to it in the afternoon. You know, I like to self-manage my time because I know that 9 to 5 or 10 till 6 or whatever is not a straight run of when I'll be my most productive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I like to feel that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so part of me, moving from city centre living out to the country now is because I feel I'm ready to be freshening up my way of working ever more so, you know. Now, for example, after we've spoke, I'll take a break from being inside, go out to the shops to get some fresh air. Because I like working in the evening. For some reason, my head likes to function looking at a screen and being productive in that way when it's dark outside. So I like having a break from where I'm living and working during the day, because unless it's an editorial brief and there's a very specific print deadline, if the schedule allows, I can juggle work in that way. So. Yeah. And I get a lot from having that slight different day to day, every day, pretty much. Yeah. Fantastic. Yoni, it's been brilliant learning just that little bit more about you today and the world of being a filmmaker and such a leader in the football creative world as you are. Could you please remind people where they can find you online and or at least where you think it would be best for people to follow your work online?
Yeah, I would definitely say the best place to follow me is on Twitter. It's at Yoni Weisberg. And from there, I'll always post my latest work, and you can find links to my various websites and other social media platforms on there.
Brilliant. Fantastic. And I highly recommend people to do so. And if I could, there's one particular piece of work that of yours that I've always really liked, because even just the lighting is done in such a lush way. It's a piece you did for Liverpool Football Club and Expedia. I think Expedia might have been, and I know it's on your illustration homepage. It's a really nice composition of a crowd walking to Anfield. And I always really, the subtle way of the lighting, I think you've really captured, like it touches on that golden hour in the evening and makes me think of like a the first European, the first home European game of an autumn. And and because another great thing about your portfolio is there are art direction variants and the specific style in that Expedia piece I meant to bring it up earlier, and so I'm giving my love for it right now.
Thank you very much for doing so. It's hugely appreciated. So that piece, it's really great that you pick up on some of those details, because that was for the last game of last season, which was the first time that a decent number of fans had been able to be back at the ground. So I think it was 10,000 for that last game. So I was working with Dave Will, who does a lot of work for the club and has art directed this series of illustrations for a number of years now. And we knew exactly what the scene wanted to be. And then we were discussing some of the specific elements. And obviously there's that line in You'll Never Walk Alone, which is at the end of the storm, there's a golden sky. So we drew from that because the idea was somewhat fans being back in the ground felt like the end of the storm. We were hoping to qualify for the Champions League, which again tied into that. So there is kind of that cool blue sky that then has a bit of a golden hour horizon, and then brought that through in wrapping the light around Anfield, and then giving everybody within the scene that kind of particular kind of hard rim light that you'll often get at that kind of day where everybody feels somewhat backlit. So bringing those elements together and at the same time obviously making it feel like a very welcoming scene was the biggest thing. So yeah, it's brilliant that you could kind of see that reflected in the artwork.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful piece of work, and anything that is architectural based in an illustration will grab my eye ever more.
Which was, I think, only like the second time that I'd really done anything like that. Like I tend to, even for my bigger pieces, they tend to just be multiplayer or multi-figure compositions. So getting that road and those kind of bay window terraced houses around Anfield, and then obviously the main stand of Anfield now has so much detail in it, so making sure to get a lot of that in there, right down to the texture of the brick and kind of the piping around some of the glass panes, was a little bit of a different journey for me because I hadn't done anything that structural before.
Well, it came out beautifully, if I may say so, Yoni. Excellent work.
Thank you very much.
And brilliant. Well, thank you for your time today. And hopefully we get to speak again in the near future.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Quickly, just as you just did, I remembered something I really wanted to say, because I didn't realise you had such an enthusiasm and passion for cinematography. And now just thinking back to so many pieces of yours of the very striking, often mono duotone stadium pieces that you do, or even some of the work that you've done for UEFA, you can really see kind of chiaroscuro lighting coming into it, because you've got very harsh elongated shadows that kind of draw through entire scenes. So as soon as you said that, I kind of could see a lot of inspiration that pulls through from almost like classic film noir lighting into your kind of work.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. And film noir, that's my at the moment. So there's a whole thing of work that's happening that I'll get to share in the near future. But it's a new kind of area, and so there's been a lot of John le Carré reading and kind of Cold War spy novels recently. And film noir was a big Even Alfred Hitchcock, and there was an era of me discovering new films and the way things were shot, and it's you're obviously a very knowledgeable man, because that reference is right up there with my biggest interests, for sure.
Great. Awesome. Brilliant.
Fantastic. Good man. Thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy your day.
Thanks, mate. You too.
Good man. Thanks a lot.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.